action. Let me see if I can actually see slides on my monitor as well. So what I want to talk about today is more or less advertisement about higher order quantum computation, which I think something I would hope more people were working on. So there are actually two ways, I think, in which logic, category theory, and these other kind of structural theories are useful in quantum computation. One of them is foundations. So this is the kind of thing Bob Coker and Samson and a lot of people at Oxford are doing, where you you axiomatize Hilbert spaces and bras and pets and operators and all these different things. Another way is semantics. And I think semantics is something different from foundations. And that's one point I sort of want to advertise and emphasize. So semantics is something like Bell inequalities of higher types, where you actually not just say, what is the axiomatization, how do I sort of enumerate quantum processes, but what are the invariants that they satisfy? Out of a possible set of all linear functions, you pick out the unitary ones, but that's trivial, that's at basic types. But for example, given some sort of operation on a black box, how can you characterize the most general operation that you can perform on a black box, right? And this usually involves some kind of Bell inequalities or something like that. So these problems have been solved in some simple cases, and they're completely wide open in some slightly less simple cases, right? So this is sort of what this talk is about. So why am I speaking of higher order types? So this is just the very first observation here is that many interesting phenomena that occur in quantum information theory actually occur at higher order types. So you may not have known this, right? You may know the phenomena, and you may not have thought about them in terms of types. So this is part of the thing that I would like to tell you about.
Thank you. So I guess, yes, you can all hear me, but on the recording, I will just be talking.
Before I tell you what types are, so in quantum information theory, usually we distinguish something called systems, which are things like qubits, electrons, and something called processes, which are operations you can perform, right? But even sort of in usual quantum information theory, the distinction is sometimes blurred, right? You can think of if you have an unknown system, you can think of how would you interact with that system to find out, to find information about it. And then usually such a system is called a black box, right? Such a process is called, if you have an unknown process and you think of it as a system that you would like to probe, then you often call it a black box. And high order types are sort of the iteration of this idea. So a type is a description of an interface of a system or process. So what kind of system it is, for example, one qubit or two qubits, or some sort of, or maybe a classical bit, or some sort of disjoint union of a classical bit and a qubit. So that would be a machine that could either output a bit, from one channel or a qubit from the other channel, something like that. And or also a qubit arrow bit, which we think of as the type of processes that can transform a qubit into a bit. For example, measurement would be one such process, but of course it's by far not the only one. So by a high order type, we mean a type where function space, such as this last example, occurs in a nested way. So this is some sort of process that can either take a function as an input or has a function as an output, or it could also be something like a pair of two functions. So anytime this function operator here occurs nested inside something else. So this first case is what's usually called a black box, right? The second case where so a process that say inputs a qubit and then becomes a process that inputs another qubit and then outputs something, you can curry that into just a single process that inputs two qubits, right? So this particular high order type is actually equivalent to a first order type, but the other two are not. So what I would like to do is actually give three examples of experiments that you know very well, right? But that I think one should think of in terms of high order types. And the first one is teleportation, which probably has been beaten to death as an example of lots of different things. So here's the teleportation procedure that you all know. So it has three distinct parts, right? The first is the preparation of the joint state, number one. The second is the measurement that Alice performs. And the third is the correction that Bob has to make, right? And there's a classical communication, just the two classical bits. I've done that as a sort of double line here, right? And all the other single lines are qubits. So in terms of the types of these operations, they're written here, right? So the preparation just really is, the preparation has no inputs, so it just has the tensor unit here as the input, right? And it outputs two qubits. And the measurement that Alice has to perform, well, she has to perform it in one particular basis, right? So that's why there's a Hadamard gate there and so on. But the type of that is she inputs two qubits and she outputs two classical bits. By the way, is there chalk? Yes. So just to relate this to this sort of terminology in terms of knob settings and so on from the previous talk. So if you have a system that inputs, say, a bunch of qubits, and it also has some knob settings, and maybe it performs some measurements, so it has some classical outputs, but it also outputs some qubits, then in our sort of notation, this whole thing would be written as a function from several qubits and several classical bits to, you know, several qubits and several classical bits, right? So we have in this formalism we have knob settings and quantum information all within the same sort of notation. It's just a difference. So we can input classical bits and qubits, or pair of a qubit and a classical bit, and so on. So this inputs two qubits and outputs two classical bits, and finally the correction inputs a qubit and two classical bits and outputs a qubit, right? So far, these are three first order functions, right? There's nothing higher order about these F1, F2, F3. Now, the way they're combined, though, is interesting. So here's again F1, F2, F3 at the top from the previous slide. So we're going to actually curry F2 and F3. So what this means, currying means if you have a function of several arguments, you regard that as a function of one argument, which returns a function of, you know, one less argument. So if you curry F2 and F3, then that becomes a function from a qubit to a function from a qubit to two bits. And F3 becomes a function from a qubit to a function from two bits to a qubit. Okay? And the way Alice and Bob combine these three functions is in this way. So they first perform F1, which is the joint, preparing the joint state. And then they apply the curried version of F2 to the qubit that Alice receives, right? And the curried version of F3 to the qubit that Bob receives. And what they end up with is something of this type here. And that's a high order type. So what Alice and Bob are actually given in the end is a pair of functions, right? Alice has a function from qubits to pairs of bits, and Bob has a function from pairs of bits to qubits. And these two functions now have the property that if Alice applies her function to a qubit, then sends the two bits to Bob, and then Bob applies his function to the two bits, then he gets as the output a qubit in the same state as the one that Alice started with. So that means, so this kind of thing in programming languages is called a thunk. So a thunk is like a machine where that has a button, right? And every time you press the button, you get a pair of functions. So the button is, in this case, this I here, because you can use the teleportation procedure only once, right? So Alice and Bob press the button, they get a pair of machines, essentially, right? Each of them has a qubit embedded inside, but they don't know this because it's a closed, because the qubit is not part of the type here. And then, and it has, so they get a pair of functions, and it has the property that H composed with G is the identity, right? And because of super dense coding, it also has the property that G composed with H is the identity. So, but you can only, so these two functions are in some sense inverses, but they're not really, right? They're not really a bijection between the type of qubits and the type of bit pairs, right? Because these are not isomorphic types. But still, you have this sort of single use isomorphic. So the point is that the functions can only be used once, right? And therefore, they're not, although they're inverses, they're not really an isomorphism in the usual sense. So of course, Alice and Bob could press the button twice, and they could get two such pairs, G and H, and another G prime and H prime, right? But if you use G prime with H, there wouldn't be inverses. And if you use G with H prime, they wouldn't be inverses, right? So this is an example of a higher order type, and it's also an example of entangled functions, right? Usually, we think only of sort of quantum objects to be entangled, whereas here, there are two black boxes that are entangled, right? And of course, what it means is that there's really a quantum state embedded in the black box somehow. So entangled functions are actually quite interesting to study, and I'll give you two more examples of where you have seen entangled functions, right, and why they are sort of non-trivial things. In terms of sort of classical logic or programming language theory or category theory, these things are completely novel. They may not sound very novel from a quantum theory point of view, but certainly we haven't seen them in any other kind of classical setting. And so the entangled function can also be viewed as just a quantum state with an interface, right? There's a quantum state, but it's inside a black box, so I can only actually interact with it by following the protocol of the black box. And that restricts the kind of questions I can ask about the quantum state and the kind of observations I can make about it. Okay, example two is the Bell inequalities, which are also well known. So in the previous example, we had entangled functions G and H that were of a type that involved qubits or pairs of bits. What's special about the Bell inequalities is that I have a pair of entangled functions, both of which have purely classical types. So they would be closed in the sense, in Lucien's sense, you know, that you have these black boxes here where all of the quantum inputs and all of the quantum outputs have been closed up. So they're really just classical functions, say, from a three-element set to a two-element set, right? But you have a pair of such functions, and they are entangled, right, in a way that cannot be simulated by local probabilistic, local hidden variable theory, right? So how can we think of that as a high-order function? So here by three, I just mean a three-element set, right, a set of three knob settings. So, okay, you have this EPR pair, right? And one copy is sent to Alice and one copy is sent to Bob. And what really makes the Bell inequalities interesting is that there are the knob settings. Without the knob settings, there would be no non-locality, right? You have to have the knob setting. And it's also precisely the knob settings that make this a higher order phenomenon somehow. So each of Alice and Bob independently chooses to measure in axes 1, 2, and 3. And then the probabilities that they observe the same values are this, right? And the Bell inequality tells you that with the local hidden variable theory, this can't happen. Something has to be greater or equal 1, but it's actually equal to 3/4. So if I state this in terms of entangled functions, I can simply say there exists a pair of entangled functions, G and H, both of a strictly classical type from a three-element set to a two-element set, which have this probabilistic behavior, namely for all x and y, the probability that g of x is equal to h of y is equal to 1 when x is equal to y and 1/4 when x is not equal to y, right? And you can convince yourself very easily that if you just had some programming language, you know, and sort of if G and H were purely probabilistic functions, then this couldn't be done, right? And that's the Bell inequality, so they violate that. But of course, with quantum functions, it can be done. So these functions are entangled. So there's sort of three different terminologies where you could describe this phenomenon. One is the terminology of logicians who would say quantum computation is not conservative over probabilistic computation. That means, so you say that one theory is conservative over another if it maybe has some additional features, but when you use only the features that already existed in the original theory, then you only get the phenomena that only existed in the original theory, right? Whereas here we have that even at classical types, quantum computation has additional phenomena, you know, relative to probabilistic computation. So it's not conservative. Category theorists would say the embedding of quantum of probabilistic computation in quantum computation is not full. That would be their terminology for the same thing. And of course, quantum information theory, people would say there's no local hidden variable theory. So they all mean the same thing. Third example is very similar to the previous one. Here, this is the approximate simulation of PR boxes. I'll just go through it quickly. The main difference is in the previous example, we had a pair of entangled functions of this type. And with PR boxes, you get a pair of entangled functions of this type. So the main purpose of the third example is just to show that you can do it even when there are only two knob settings, right? And you still get something. You still get something that's not conservative. And that's the smallest example. So if you make any of these four things a one element set, then there are no, then everything is hidden variables. Right? So the point is just that with a probabilistic theory, you can simulate a PR box sort of 75% of the time, and with strict quantum, if you're allowed to use quantumness, then you can do it 85.36% of the time, but no better, right? So there's a Bell type inequality also that tells you can do no better than 85.36%. And of course, if you had something even stronger than quantum theory, like PR boxes themselves added as a primitive, then you could do this 100% of the time, right? So all the three examples that I gave involved higher order functions of the higher order types, rather, that were basically a tensor product of two first order types. And then we see that there are some phenomena there. And you could ask more generally, you know, what happens at all the higher order types? In particular, what happens when you iterate higher order types? You know, for example, we know what all the so at first order, this is a completely understood problem. Like, we know what the most general operation is from a qubit to a qubit, right? It's a super operator, and that's all, right? These are exactly the possible operations if you go in the most general sort of probabilistic mixed setting. But we don't know. It's not easy to characterize higher order super operators. Like, what are exactly what kind of operations can you characterize the set of all possible operations that input a black box that inputs and outputs a qubit, and then output a qubit. So you can probe this black box in many different ways and mixed ways and so on. And you can iterate this, right? So iterated black boxes are something that haven't really been studied a lot at all. And the experience from logic is that every time you go one order higher in the type, not only does the question get vastly more complicated, but they're usually qualitatively new things that start to happen if you go to a higher type. So even if you can answer this question completely for types up to order 3, you know, there could still be some open, difficult problem for types of order 4 and so on. So what exactly are, so these are some questions, right? What exactly are the quantum definable functions at higher order types? Do they exist Bell-like situations at all higher order types, or maybe just some, right? And what kind of new, or are there any new phenomena that happen as the complexity of the types increases? So as someone who does semantics, I would really like to find a fully complete semantics of higher order quantum computation. And what this means in sort of normal terminology is exactly, can you characterize exactly the elements of any sort of type like this? So in case of types of this sort of structure here, we always find that there is some set of Bell inequalities or Bell-like inequalities. The actual Bell inequalities are for local hidden variable theories, right? And they give you a polytope cutting out exactly the things that you can do with local hidden variable theories. But then there are Bell-like inequalities that, for example, out of your space of possible behaviors, cut out exactly the things you can do with quantum theory, right? Or exactly the things you can do with PR boxes and so on. So it would be nice to have a sort of generalization of that that sort of recursively works for all high order types. And that's a very difficult problem and it is open. Let me give you some ideas as to, let me be a bit more precise about, or give you at least a better idea of what the problem actually is, right? So in fact, this is already quite difficult to do just for classical types. So think of a bit, right? So a bit is either 0 or 1. If you think of the possible mixed states of a bit, then that's, of course, given by a pair PQ. So just the probability distribution of bits, right? The P plus Q. Well, usually is equal to 1, though sometimes you might like to allow less than or equal 1 if you're talking about partial probability distributions. Because at least in computing, you can think of a program of type bit that either returns true or it returns false, or with some probability, maybe it just runs forever, right, and doesn't return anything. But at any given time, you don't know if it's going to return something in the future, right? If you think of all the possible functions from classical bits, all possible probabilistic functions, right, from classical bits to classical bits, then it's very easy to write down the potential behavior of such a function, right? If f is such a function, then, the whole behavior of f is somehow given by just two pieces of information, right? What is f of 0 and what is f of 1? So f of 0 will be either 0 or 1 with some probabilities p and q. Writing here, it's not really equal to, it's equal to the, well, it's a probabilistic function, so it would be described by this probability distribution. And f of 1 has some probability distribution, right? So the whole, the potential behavior of such a thing is just given by a four-tuple of numbers, p, q, p prime, q prime, right? And to be an actual admissible behavior, it has to satisfy two very simple Bell-type inequalities, namely p plus q is less than or equal 1 and p prime plus q prime is less than or equal 1. And in this case, there's no interaction or no more complicated condition because f of 0 really can be defined completely independently of f of 1, right? Another sort of special case is what I would call a co-bit. That is a function that inputs a bit but outputs only a, well, what is the type 1? It's like bits, but there's only one of them, right? So it outputs only a singleton. That means such a function can either terminate or not terminate, right? So g of 0 will just terminate with probability a, say, and g of 1 terminates with probability b. So the co-bit would be described by a pair AB. But in this case, it's different than this here, right? Because A and B are both less than or equal 1, but their sum is completely irrelevant, right? So in this case, you have the maximum of A and B is less than or equal 1. Let me write a little almost U-shaped thing here for the supremum or maximum. So these are all first-order types, right? And therefore, they're very easy, and we understand them perfectly. Now, when we go to a higher-order type, I claim even with simple types like bit and 1, there are some questions that are harder and some questions that are open. Okay. So we should think of a probabilistic bit as a machine with one button, right? And each time I press the button, each time I press the button, a bit comes out, right? And I can maybe press the button many times. And so I can estimate the probability distribution on the bit. And we should think of a qubit as a machine with two buttons. I have a choice of pressing the left button or the right button. But if I press, say, the left button, then a light goes on with a certain probability, right? What about a co-qubit? OK, the simplest possible thing you can think of that's actually higher order would be a co-qubit. So this is a machine that has a slot, right? And into the slot, I put a qubit, right, which is itself a kind of black box. And then the machine can interact with this qubit in any way that it wants. And in the end, it may decide to terminate with a certain probability. And just for simplicity, let's restrict ourselves to the case where the machine is actually allowed to query the qubit exactly once, right? If you're allowed to query the qubit many times, then you get vastly more possible behaviors. But even in the case, let's restrict ourselves to the strictly linear case. Okay, so you can query the qubit. You can query the qubit exactly once. So I would call this type of machine a co-qubit, right? And the, one of the questions is it the same thing as a bit? You know, because a co-co should somehow be the same as the original thing. Well, OK, so let's think about this sort of manually, right? What can this machine actually do? Well, it's given its qubit. Now, it could, first of all, with a certain probability, decide to diverge and just not do anything, right? So it could wait an infinite amount of time. Or it could query the qubit, in which case it has to provide it actually with a bit, right? So so it could decide to with a certain probability it could put 0 into the qubit, and with a certain probability it could put 1, right? And then if the qubit doesn't terminate, then the whole process doesn't terminate, right? Because we have to wait for the qubit to actually give an answer before we can react, right? And if it does terminate, then we could still decide with a certain probability to diverge and with a certain probability just to terminate. So these are somehow all the possible things that the co-qubit could actually do, right? Now, it's very easy to see that if the machine decides to diverge at the very beginning, then this doesn't add anything to the possible behaviors, because it could just write itself a note with a certain probability, right? And then decide at the end not to terminate, right? So, and in fact, so all we really need to describe this behavior here is a certain probability P with which the co-qubit is going to put 0 into the qubit, and a certain probability Q with which the co-qubit is going to put 1 into a qubit, into the qubit. Right, and they may add up to something less than 1 in case the machine decides to wait forever and basically neither put a P nor a Q into the qubit. Okay. So the set of possible behaviors is actually exactly the same as the set of possible behaviors of a probabilistic fit. It's just a set of, it's given by the same type of probability distribution. Yep. Yes, so that happens when p plus q is less than 1. Right? Because p is the probability we're going to query the qubit with 0, and q is the probability of querying the qubit with 1. And I actually stated it wrong. If we decide at the end to diverge, then we could have just built that into the probability. And if we decide at the end to diverge, we could have built that into the probability. So on the one hand, we find that a co-qubit actually is the same thing as a bit. Namely, their set of possible behaviors is completely the same. On the other hand, they are not actually the same. And you see this like that. So given a, this thing has gone off because I've used the blackboard. If they were literally isomorphic, then it should be possible, if you give me an unknown co-qubit, that I should actually extract a bit.
right? Because isomorphism means that there should be functions going either way, right? Such that these functions are each other's inverses. Now, given a bit, I can certainly produce a cocobit that has the correct behavior, right? And I build the cocobit as a machine that simply just queries the bit, and then uses the answer to query the cobit, right? And then terminates the problem. So this thing exists, but this thing doesn't. So this has something to do not with the state of, not with the set of possible states of a cocobit, but with the interactions that you're allowed to have with it. So if I'm given a cocobit, I know it has a bit inside somewhere, right? But because the only way I can interact with it is by putting in a cobit, you know, what cobit could I possibly put in, right? I could put in the cobit which on input 0 always converges and on input 1 always diverges, right? And if I put in that cobit, then I sort of obtain P, but I don't get any information about Q. And I could put in a dual sort of cobit where I could query Q but obtain no information about P. So this is interesting because it tells you that the description of a type is not just the set of possible behaviors. There's some additional component that we haven't yet captured that also restricts the way that you can interact with these things. Now, so what I'm saying is that while all the above types are more or less what you expect, this thing here, if you think of it as a type, has some unexpected things. For example, the identity. I mean, this left-hand side is correct. So that any such process would have to be a linear function mapping pairs PQ to some other pairs Q prime Q prime, right? And there's a four-dimensional space of possible linear functions here. But of all the ones that are potentially there, there are some restrictions. For example, the identity is not an element of this higher type here, right? So you would like to find some sort of generalized Bell inequality type thing that tells you exactly what are the elements. And right now I'm only talking with actual probabilistic theories. I haven't talked about quantum theory yet. Right. So with hidden variables, so there's a simple theorem that tells you that if you only want to study probabilistic theories, then the answer is always a polytope. So here you have, right, the set of possible behaviors here is always given by some finite number of parameters. And the if you want to pick out the parameters that are actually possible, it's obviously always a convex set. That is clear because you know, given one operation and given another operation, you could just perform a mixture of the two. But in the probabilistic hidden variable case, this convex set is always a polytope, which means it's generated by finitely many extremal points. And the reason for that is that essentially, conceptually, it's easy. It just means the extremal points are just your deterministic functions. You could unwind every probabilistic operation by saying, well, I'm going to throw some dice at the beginning and then execute one of several possible deterministic functions. Right. By deterministic, I mean it could still diverge, right? But every possible behavior it always has with probability 1. And of course, if you also allow quantumness, then you don't get a polytope. Usually you don't, right? But you might still get some invariants or inequalities that outline exactly what the elements are, but they're now going to be infinitely many inequalities. Or dually, your convex set is spanned by infinitely many extremal points. And to have an actual, we would like to have an actual formalism like some sort of machine, where you input a type, and then it just spits out, you know, the infinitely many equalities. Probably they're parameterized by some real or complex parameters, and it should just somehow spit out a representation of the possible behavior. And such a machine, to find such a mechanism that works even for types up to order 3 is an open problem as far as I know. Now, so I will tell you what the state of the art is, and then we'll have some time for questions. First of all, there's no open question of this nature at first order types, right?
at first order types, so I mean things that are not high order, right? So everything of this sort of nature here. The admissible operations are precisely the super operators, and we know exactly what they are. And given a linear function, we can test whether it's a super operator or not, right? The simplest possible high order type is this type here, and there was work last year that Tony Asin presented at the Obergurgel conference, at least that's where I saw it for the first time, where they give an infinite hierarchy of necessary conditions for something to be an element of a type of this form here. So think of this as a generalized Bell experiment, where Alice and Bob are allowed to share some arbitrary quantum state, maybe not an EPR, maybe some number of EPR states or any other kind of entangled state, where there's no limit on the dimension of that state, okay. And then Bob has N1 possible knob settings and M1 possible measurement outcomes, and Alice has N2 possible knob settings and M2 possible measurement outcomes, right? So in this kind of generalized Bell experiment, you could ask, what are the inhabitants of this type? In other words, what are the possible quantum correlations that you can have in an arbitrary experiment of this form? And so Asin and his co-authors wrote down a number of non-trivial necessary conditions. Like, they're not the first thing you would come up with. They involve semi-definite programming. And unfortunately, it's an infinite family of such conditions. So, and they get higher and higher dimensional. So this does not immediately give you an algorithm. There's not immediately an algorithm to test positively or negatively whether a given operation actually satisfies the entire hierarchy of the necessary condition, right? And it's not known to be complete either. So they check 10 different examples of Bell type experiments in the literature, and in all cases, it gave the actual correct bound after two steps of this hierarchy. Right. So it's a very promising thing. But so what we don't, right, so it's for types of this form. So notice that N1, N2, M1, and M2 are just classical. Right. So you can ask the same question with qubits here instead of bits. Right. And then I think even nothing is known right now about that. Except we know it's not a polytope, right? Now, in the general case where you want to allow arbitrary higher order types, even less is known in some sense. But we have sort of worked the last few years towards this problem. So so the first thing we did is, being programming language people, we came from the direction of syntax. So Benoit Valeyran and I we defined a lambda calculus. So a lambda calculus is a kind of prototype programming language in which you can express higher order functions. So we just took the standard lambda calculus and we extended it with quantum features. And there were several problems to solve to actually get that to work. But so we have a sort of syntax for higher order quantum computations now. So one can say with some confidence that the possible higher order quantum computations are exactly the ones that can be expressed in this language. So in some sense, a philosophical problem has now been turned into a mathematical problem, right? And we have an operational semantics, so there is a rule by which you actually evaluate the lambda terms and actually obtain the probabilities with which it's going to have different behaviors, right? But what we didn't have is a denotational semantics for this calculus, and what this means in information theoretic terms is we didn't have a set of invariants by which you can actually prove that something is not doable by a higher order quantum operation, right? In some sense, the terms enumerate all the things that you can do, but you very often want invariants, such as Bell inequalities, telling you what are the things you cannot do, so that you have the set pinned down exactly. As recent as maybe 2 weeks ago, my other student, Octavio Malherbe, and I think we found an example, we found a model, actually, for this language using pre-sheaves. So there is apparently a denotational model now. I think there are one or two lemmas that we still have to check. And if they're false, then the whole thing doesn't work, right? But we think they're probably true. But the problem is that while we have a model, it's not actually fully complete. This means you can compute the the model gives you a notion of behavior, and it's in such a way that all terms actually can be translated to such a behavior, right? But there could be some behaviors in the model that are not actually the image of some term. So that means we have some set of invariants, but not necessarily a complete set of invariants, right? Also, last year at the QPL conference in Reykjavik, Benoit presented some work where he had defined a notion of Kripke semantics. So this is something that will be familiar to the semantics people in the audience from the anti-calculus. It's a similar idea to what we try to do here naively. But you see, the identity function, for example, here we have an inequality and here we have an inequality. And the identity function preserves it, but is not actually admissible, right? So we need something more general than just an inequality to define the to describe the space, right? And the idea of this sort of Kripke norm semantics is that you don't just define, you know, you could say the norm of such a pair PQ is just P plus Q, right? And then you could here speak of norm preserving function. And that's certainly a necessary condition for the function to be admissible. But we find that you need to extend this to something like a multinorm. So instead of just speaking of the norm of one element of your space, you need to speak of the norm of some finite subset of elements of your space. And then the functions need to preserve this multinorm in a way. This sort of corresponds to the intuition that I can ask questions about zero, or I can ask questions about one, but I can't ask the two questions simultaneously. So somehow, what limits my information flow in one coordinate or in another coordinate, there might be a joint limit also to the sort of joint questions that I can, how much questions I can ask with a single query, right? And this is actually fully complete, even at higher types. So it answers, in some sense, it's a complete answer at all types to this question about bits that I posed here, but only for probabilistic computation. So this is a way of computing the polytope, right? But we have not yet extended that to quantum computation. So you can see that we're sort of zeroing in into various directions of this problem, but on the whole, it's still a wide open problem. I think it's interesting, and I believe that's the end. So we have maybe 2 minutes for questions.
So have you looked at, or anyone, has anyone looked at this valuable thing, that you, this fully complete thing that you just mentioned, you know, what that might tell you about the question that Asin and Vasquez and Colonio investigated? Does it give you the same hierarchy or some more compact thing?
No, it doesn't, because the Valeron thing, the Kripke relations is only in the probabilistic case. So it's a way to compute the polytope. A posteriori is not a hard problem anyway, because you can already compute the polytope by just enumerating all the deterministic functions.
So what was the difference between what they did?
So what Asin did and his co-authors is actually, right, so inside some type, you have the polytope that can be achieved by all the local hidden variable theories. And then above that is a thing that's not a polytope. It's defined by some quadratic equation, presumably.
So the type was possible.
That you can do by quantum things.
So the functions can be attained.
And then above that, you have all the stuff you can do by PR boxes, which is, again, a polytope.
And they were looking at the middle one.
They were looking at the middle one. Right. Okay. So it's not just an equation. It could be done by just an equation. It would have to be at least a quadratic equation. But they do this with semi-definite programming, which is a kind of way of handling.
I just got confused again. Yeah. Type was class.
Yeah, as you probably know, there is a whole industry of multi-party Bell-Lang inequalities. I think initiated by Reinhard Werner and how are these related to what you're looking for? Or is this a completely different meta?
Well, a multi-party Bell-Lang inequality would be presumably a similar kind of thing, but where you have a tensor of three or four or five instead of a tensor of just two things. So the answer is, as far as I know, in the general case, it's still open. I think at least the Asin criteria only applies to the bipartite case. But that would be another special. If one could answer the general question about higher order types,
that would also then, as a special case, answer the question about multipartite. And therefore, it's a hard question.
Correct.
Andreas, did you have one?
Yes, I have a question, actually. I find it interesting that both in teleportation and in Bell's inequalities, you have to have classical bits in there. Mm-hmm. Are there examples? I'm not aware, right away, of examples where you just have qubits and then still have something interesting. What would be going on?
Yes, so if you look at the type qubit arrow qubit, tensor qubit arrow qubit, I bet you could not immediately characterize just what other possible pairs of entangled functions of that.
We could also not say physically well.
You can't, in that case, say that it's not conservative over hidden variables because you can't even say what it means to be a hidden variable theory if the output is a qubit.
Mm. I'll take two more questions. Robin and Mike.
No. If you thought about the connection to the work by Mauro Dariano and his group,
mm-hmm.
So they look at the maps between quantum operations and quantum operations.
Codes?
Yeah, the quantum cones.
Yep.
So and then they show that if you ask about maps between cones and cones, you just get more cones.
Yep.
So the hierarchy ends there.
I think I just convinced Mauro in Oxford that that's actually false. So there is this work on cones. A comb is just a quantum circuit with some holes in it, and you can plug the holes with some other unitary operators or maybe CP maps or whatever. But the point is that there are some higher order operations in our understanding of higher order operations that cannot actually be done by combs. And one of them is a circuit that has a knob. You plug in two operators F and G, and if the knob is set to 0, you compute FG, and if the knob is set to 1, you compute GF. So with a comb, I think you can't do that because it has the left-to-right sort of restriction. But it's clearly a high-order operation and there's a physical way of implementing it.
So a qubit is its own dual, rather like a photon, and you've got a compact category. Why isn't qubit to qubit just qubit star tensor qubit?
No, a qubit is not its own dual. Right, so there is this sort of Cocker setting of compact closed categories, right? And there are two different things. One is the general sort of space, like what dimension matrices do you have to describe operators of this type? And there's another, which is what are the Bell inequalities that actually tell you what are the actual inhabitants of this type? So the mixed state of a qubit is a 2x2 matrix of trace less than or equal to 1. Whereas a mixed state of a co-qubit would be an observation on a qubit, and that's a 2x2 with maximum eigenvalue bounded by 1. Right? So they're of the same type, right? In the compact closed setting, but they're not actually the same space. So the difference between compact closed categories and this is what we describe here would be a subcategory of the compact closed setting.
Well, let's thank both of our speakers again.